game, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Decade Project. This is a One Heat Minute Productions Patreon, preliminarily exclusive podcast with me, your host, Blake Howard, where I get great guests to look back 10 years into our review to see the movies that are still hanging around, the movies that are deeply underrated, or those that are ripe for revisiting. Now, the film and the guest that I'm talking about today have visited not only many homes, but also many podcasts on One Heat Minute Productions Network. It's a film that's been referenced countless times. It's a 2015 film that today, even today as we're recording, I mentioned to a friend that we were recording this, and they said, holy shit, has it been 10 years? The film we're talking about is Mad Max Fury Road, and the incredibly talented, prodigious author, screenwriter, journalist, and absolute
furious driver.
Scumbag.
Absolute schlanger.
Schlanger is my dear friend Maria Lewis. Take a listen to the trailer of Mad Max Fury Road, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
In this wasteland, I am the one who runs from both the living and the dead. A man reduced to a single instinct. Survive.
We are not things. We are not things.
Where is she taking them? I want them back. They're my property.
Oh, what a day! What a lovely day!
Wanna get through this?
Let's go!
Welcome back.
Blake Howard, thank you so much for riding historic with me on the Fury Road.
Exactly. I'm just putting my hands up to the sign of the V8 gods like this.
Beep, beep. Who got the keys to my Jeep? A Missy Elliott line that unfortunately was not in Mad Max Fury Road, but would have been sick if they added
it. Single floor. Mad Max Fury Road is 10 years old. Furiosa came out last year.
Ew, we don't even talk about it.
Ew. I'm just trying to set the scene. But
such a miserable night. I literally had tonsil surgery 2 days earlier and had been so excited to see this movie, even though I hated the trailer and I didn't think the movie should exist, like on an intellectual principle. And then I went and saw it and I was convinced it shouldn't have existed. I hated it so much.
Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about
Well, you brought it up.
The first night. that that I saw this movie was the Australian premiere. Oh, we sat next to each other.
We sure did.
In the Australian premiere. And I remember we
at the fucking hell dystopian hell on earth that is known as George Street Cinemas.
Much like The Wasteland. We sat down next to each other. We found each other that screening. We were very keen to see it together. We sat down and I genuinely remember this so few times as it happened in like a holistic movie experience. But we sat down. Usually you and I like whisper dumb jokes to each other.
Silence.
It's just complete silence. And we were both gripping the hand rests next to each other because we were right next to each other. We're gripping it. And then literally the moment that the war rig actually goes through the storm and there's a moment of like black that comes up on the screen, we both just went, oh, it's just like we'd been holding our breath.
I'm so glad you brought that up because that is my most visceral memory of that premiere too. And it was the scene where Max is laying covered in the sand and it's orange and we both turned to each other and we went, wow.
Like, what the fuck was that?
It was breathless. Like, we were breathless. And I guess it's really hard. Like, I don't know, looking back on it, what I find so interesting is I don't think we knew what was coming. Like, that trailer was great, sure. The trailer was vibes. It was tone. It was interesting. It was all of that. But, you know, there'd been the can standing O, but who gives a fuck about those? Because they standing O for literally anything. So it's never a barometer of taste or interest.
I do want to shout out our mutual friend, the great Garth Franklin from Dark Horizons, who often he triangulates like the can standing O's, like he tracks them. Well, and then he does a follow-up article, which is even funnier, which is like what that actually translated to. Was that box office? Was that critical acclaim? Yes. Was that anything? So
it's
shout out
to
Garth.
My favorite recurring Dark Horizons bits, absolutely. But that premiere was so like interesting, and I remember being so tired. I was thinking about this in the lead up to us recording, and as we're recording this, it's been this past weekend has been the exact 10th anniversary, and so there's been lots of social media posts from all of our favorites in it, people who worked on it. Particularly, my favorite story to come from the set of Mad Max Fury Road is Riley Keough meeting her husband and father of her child now, who was a stuntie, who played one of the war boys and Dwarf Warriors, which I just kind of love. And also, like, there were so many marriages that came from that movie. But anyway, in the lead up to this, I was thinking about this movie and its legacy and what it means to both of us. And I genuinely do not think there is a film that I have written more words about in my life than Mad Max Fury Road, because I was a journalist at the time. And so I had been covering the pre-pro, fail-pro, pre-pro, fail-pro, pro-pro, post-pro, pre-pro, in lead-up-pro of Mad Max Fury Road for almost 10 years. Like, for as long as they had been trying to get that film up, I had been a journalist. And so I'd been reporting on it literally for years. Anyway, then the film's a go and I was covering everything. This was for the Daily Telegraph at the time. And I fully was down there that day. They did this big setup activation at the Sydney Opera House where they did all of, like, they had all the war boys doing the stunts with the flames, with the polecats on the war rig there, all the different cars. They had Rictus Erectus there just like meeting and greeting and pressing the flesh. And so I was covering it all day, genuinely from like 8 a.m. and then had to go straight to the premiere at Dystopian Wasteland, that is Event Cinemas George Street, and then do all of those red carpet interviews. And then we found each other. Like, we always have a rule that whoever gets in there first saves seats.
And I got in first because you were so busy.
Dude, it was bananas. We get in, you picked great seats as you always do. God bless you. We see the movie. It was incredible. And then this is how long ago it was. I recorded a Vine that was my reaction to the film, which was just me screaming as I walked down the hallway with all you guys in the background. And that was like my big Vine viral success. And then post Mad Max Fury Road, that movie coming out, and again, writing about it, writing so many think pieces and analysis pieces. And I can't even tell you how many pieces I wrote following that just reflecting on the film.
You did cast off, so you did so many interviews for Mad Max that we did, you did cast off interviews which you gave to Graffiti with Punctuation, which we still existed at the time.
I did Daily Telegraph, I did Daily Mail.
You funneled so many pieces.
Guardian.
And then you ran out. So you're like, I'm just going to funnel these to you because I can't fund them because I have no more places that I can take this.
Literally, because it's such a rich textual film. But then after all the journalism coverage of it, fast forward many years later and I'm working as a curator and programmer at ACME, the Australian Centre for Moving Image, and they are about to, I was hired there to work on essentially rebooting their permanent free film exhibition. If you're ever in Melbourne and you know what a film is, highly recommend going to that exhibition. Blake has an incredible piece about Sweet Country in there.
Oh yeah.
And
thanks McGregor. For my signed copy of Sweet Country, which literally says Stephen.
So for those who don't know, Stephen McGregor, the incredible, one of like literally the greatest living screenwriters this country's ever produced, is a mate of mine, and I told him all about how Blake had done this incredible piece on Sweet Country for ACME and how much he loves this film. And so we were working in a office that had a bunch of DVDs for various projects that McGregor had worked on. And so we were putting them in our bags and stealing them. And I took one and I said, can we sign this for Blake? He would lose his shit. And McGregor is so fame averse and like praise averse that he wrote Stephen to Blake, Stephen. I was like, is that what? And I think he'd just written your name. And I'm like, that makes no sense. That's so stupid.
Writing to Blake on a Blu-ray is something I could do with
so funny.
2,000 Blu-rays in this room.
So funny. But fast forward all these years later to working at ACME, and I worked on a whole section of that exhibition, which was all about Mad Max. Not just Mad Max Fury Road. It was about the original Mad Max. It was about Road Warrior. It was about Thunderdome. And it was also about the legacy of Mad Max and the way that it has popped up in everything from Tupac in California to Moana and the Kookamore and how they were referencing Fury Road to Spice Girls video clips, everything, you name it. And so I wrote essays. I literally have written books and books and books on this movie. Have interviewed everyone from Colin Gibson, who won the Oscar for production design with Lisa Simpson, to Jenny Bevan, to George Miller. Sent me a signed Mad Max poster one time, just like for shits and gigs, because I'd done so much work on it. And
shout out to Dr. George. I have a 3,000 years of longing poster.
What a legend. Anyway, so it's just really wild to think about like all of the, there's so many important films in my life, but Mad Max Fury Road is the film undoubtedly that I've written the most words about.
It's an incredible film. And
it's a perfect movie.
It's a perfect movie. And one of the rare things is it struck a chord both critically and culturally at the time where...
Almost instantly.
Instantly. So there was a voracious, immediate, frothing fandom that already existed for Mad Max. It came out, it exceeded all of their expectations. Critics universally praised it. It had great feeling amongst the entire artistic community around the world. Obviously, not necessarily just because of like content. It's full on. It's extremely violent. It's not like a four quadrant movie you can take the family to, but it ended up making a stack of money.
Well, you know what it really reminds me a lot of, just thinking about where we are at this moment, is it's really giving hashtag Sinners.
Yeah, really.
The way that Sinners has had Sinners, the legs that it has had theatrically is not comparable to Mad Max Fury Road, because what Sinners is doing hasn't been done since literally shit like The Fugitive and Shrek. So it's a league of its own and completely different. But the way that it had incredible word, like the universal critical acclaim, universal audience acclaim, and then the way that it had this amazing word of mouth buzz where it felt like almost immediately it had become a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Immediately it had become this cult sensation. Immediately it was underappreciated at the Oscars. It's like you look back on, and to be fair, that was a great Oscars year. There was a spotlight year, but you look back on it and you're just like, this film is truly like it's an immediate masterpiece in a way that Sinners feels like that. And there were things on screen that you had just genuinely never seen before, whether that was obviously action stunt pieces and the way things are being filmed, but also the characters, the construction, the pacing, the score, all of those elements, all of the craft elements and heads of department all linking up together in the same way as Sinners. It's like, it just felt like one of those moments where it was an example of why you love movies and why loving movies is like such a wholesome, non-abusive relationship.
It was it like in the framework of the Decade Project, we usually talk about, you know, films that have had a tepid preliminary reaction, they then gain some notoriety, they then sort of like, you know, crystallize as part of the cultural canon and get revisited or reclaimed or whatever. But Mad Max Fury Road, almost instantaneously, universally, as we just said, like loved. And years later, it feels like, and this is something that, you know, is sort of in the popular culture because of things like The Ringer, but like the championship action movie belt. And a big shout out to my friend Brandon Streisnig and Bilge Ibiri, who were some of the champions that led to the not only the Vulture Stunt Awards, but the Stunt Awards being recognized at the Academy. It feels like that's still like Fury Road, if there was a championship belt, is still like basically holds the belt.
Well, you know, talking about decade projects, it's essentially the momentum for a stunt Oscar
starts
with this film. And it doesn't happen if this film isn't like up for Best Picture, isn't up for Best Director, still one of the great Oscar oversights and makes me absolutely sick to my stomach is no Charlize Theron nomination. What the fuck? Are you joking me? Not even a nomination, you dogs. Like, what the fuck? Not since Angela Bassett losing to fucking Hot Dog Fingers Jamie Lee Curtis had I been so furiosa about a situation. And she, like, you know, at least Bassett was fucking nominated. Like, Charlize Theron is given one of the great female cinematic performances ever, to the point you see it on shirts, you see it on tattoos, you see it on street art and graffiti. It is iconic and was almost immediately iconic. That, anyway, all of that genuine momentum, because it was successful financially, absolutely, but it wasn't like, you know, Avengers Endgame or whatever.
No, but that's like, it's such an impossible thing. It's an incredibly successful movie made like over $300 million internationally.
It was successful enough that they got into a legal dispute about where the profits went.
That's genuine success.
Thank you.
That is genuine success.
Let's talk about it.
Where's the money going, guys?
They were like, babe, we'll let you make this genie movie if you just like fucking settle this out of court.
But also what's hilarious about that, hilarious and heartbreaking, is that the guys who wrote Men in Black still haven't gotten any money.
Hollywood accountant.
Yeah.
Like, we know how, like, we know exactly, like, every time it spends a profit, you immediately reinvest that back into some kind of campaign or some kind of cooking the books. That is why you get your, why do we need to get into this?
Just pause. It's a separate conversation.
Men in Black, though, perfect 90-minute movie. Just saying.
Yeah. Great. Like,
sugar. Water. The best.
Sugar.
Water. Like, fucking so, I wish he was still doing that character instead of fucking shitting the bed with Kingpin nonstop. But anyway.
Oh, so good. But yeah, so it's only aged great. And usually, like, I would reserve it to the end of a conversation, but like the sliding doors for this, I wanted to particularly talk to you about because you wrote about it for so long. Is like, this story was cooking with George Miller for so long. Is there any, do you have any favorite tidbits, like news-ish tidbits about like sliding doors moments of casting and other things that happened around this movie?
Well, I mean, there's so many, obviously the, not to get into like the juice of it all, but Mel Gibson, obviously, was meant to be the lead of this for so long and just kept fucking shit up and just, like, literally couldn't stop being racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic. Like, you pick a thing. He was an it-kick. Anyway, now he's a liaison for Hollywood and we're getting Two Passion, Two Christ. So it all worked out for the best, I guess.
So much better than whatever it is, the resurrection of the Christ would be Two Passion,
We get
Two
it.
Christ.
Everyone knows he was resurrected. Like, shit.
Spoilers.
Hello.
I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics that's gentle on my stomach and gives me smooth, steady energy. Right now, get 61% off your first Coffee Plus starter kit and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
Anyway, so I think the bait and switch of how the movie, what happens when you lose literally the title character is so bonkers, bananas, crazy. It's Mad Max, and those are the films more than anything else in his career. Yes, okay, Lethal Weapon made him a star in the US for sure, definitely. Braveheart is that bitch, go hard, like run around in a kilt, go off babes. But it was Mad Max that made him a cultural icon.
Yes.
And he is Max, and he was mad. Like, Mad Mel was the tabloid headline. So it was this impossible feat of, like, how do you reset this narrative and how do you reset this franchise without your leading man, unlike a Dark Knight scenario where your leading man has passed away in between Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises. Like, that's an impossible task. What's also an impossible task is when – like, imagine if Heath Ledger had been still alive, running around, do all kinds of crazy shit. It's like there's not a full stop to that narrative. It's constantly being regurgitated and re-put into the cycle, into the news cycle. So the fact that they were able to reconfigure that franchise is fascinating to me. The thing that I think is the enduring marvel and masterpiece of Mad Max Fury Road, to me, is specifically to take a franchise that has historically been about, not, well, you know, it's about cars and dystopia, whatever, but a franchise that has historically had women as completely expendable collateral. Yeah, okay.
And and also, like, the big thing for me in the Mad Max franchise, and it really starts in the first, like, Max film, is just how, like, women are vulnerable in this dystopic world. They are, they're bait.
It's not just that they're... like vulnerable, they are collateral.
Yeah.
Rape is the currency of the future. Yeah. And it's so, I was rewatching the original Mad Max quite recently, actually only a few weeks ago. And it, my order, I'm just going to ignore Furiosa, it doesn't even count to me. But my order had always been 4-3-2-1.
Yeah.
Like I love Thunderdome. I think it's like actually a really special movie.
Yeah, it is special.
So we don't need another hit. Sorry, your kids are in bed. Oh, Auntie Tina. But you could see the shift starting to happen in the way that, like, he always had interesting female villains and stuff like that. But women being murdered and raped and traded and all of that was, like, a core tenet of the franchise, a very rapey franchise. And then you get to Fury Road and it's like, oh, we're not going to do revisionist history. Actually, our legacy, like the film and the plot itself, we're going to do a cul-de-sac on it, baby.
Yeah.
We're going to make this about it. This is like, we're not going to hide from the thing that would tar our legacy. We're going to tackle it and drive into it head fucking first, bitch. Like, people are not property, to quote Auntie Entity. Like, it's just really interesting and hugely intellectual, while at the same time so serviceable and functional. That was always the masterpiece of it for me. The construction of the wives, brilliant, great, interesting, Furiosa and her connection to them and her pursuit of this green place. Excellent, wonderful, amazing. It's when the Volvani come in and it's this perfect bookend of like these women who were wet, like their bodies were used as a weapon of war, as brides to be breeders and all this kind of shit, the milking mamas, that's exactly where I would end up, sidebar. Like, you always play that game of like, who would you be in?
They'd
see my tits and they'd fucking plug me up to a milker like that. And I love milk. I could give you so many different flavor combinations. I drink a lot of milk. From my tit, but just like in the dystopia, I'd be valued as a milker.
I would totally just be like a scummy war boy, like wearing an apron.
You'd be the first to go. You'd have a tumor on every elbow. You'd just be like, you'd be one tumor minute over here. But it's when the Volvani come in that was the moment where I was just like, wow. Not only is this something I had never seen before in my fucking life, old female action heroes, but it was also who those bad bitches were. They were, for many of us Australians, they were faces that we had seen on our television and films for years.
Yes.
It was the way they interacted with the young girls and this understanding of, and so we call it, well, I mean, there's like all different versions of what you would call this, but like the ancestral power you get from older generations, the knowledge and the mana that can be passed down from an auntie or an elder to the next, and having that respect and reverence for your elders, and having the respect and reverence for ritual as well. You see that with, what's her name? Abby Lee Kershaw's character, and her mimicking the rituals of like of the mothers and the plants and the seedlings, and all of that was just so incredible. And never sacrificing the actual story, because the stakes of it were so high. It's like you introduce these amazing women and this amazing story. You have to see people die. Like, so sorry to Mrs. Jason Statham, who was a horrible death. Like, Prego
Horrible and gruesome.
Prego sauce under the tires, gruesome, brutal, but meant something. And then same with all the Volvani. Every single Volvani you lose, it meant something. Every death meant something. And half of these women, when met for 10 minutes and you still felt it. And also, as like an additional layer upon the layer, I've always found George Miller's representation of Pacifica women, specifically Māori women, across his work really fascinating to me, because there hasn't always been representations or spaces of Aboriginal people. So I'd always been really curious as to what it is about Māori culture, but specifically Māori women, that sees them presented quite frequently in his work. And Fury Road, there are a few different references to it, both like literal and in different ways. And you also have representations of Aboriginal people, albeit as ghosts. But Corny Eaton is Māori. And by the end of the film, when her character's coming into her power, she's wearing essentially a version of a traditional Māori headdress wrapped around her head. And then also Megan Gale, who was famously going to be his Wonder Woman back when he was making Justice League Mortal.
That's bait.
That's bait. Also, hello, just while we're there, that's bait. Underrated, fucking hilarious movie. Fucking hilarious movie. Like, that. The comedy of Mad Max Fury Road is not spoken to enough.
It's got good comedy. And also, just on the entire architecture of the whole movie, I've loved to pieces my entire, like, since we saw it, hearing new filmmakers just go, I don't know, like someone like,
I don't know who did
that. Yeah, like someone like Steven Soderbergh.
Oh my God, where he's like, I don't know how I would have done it. If I had tried, I would have killed 100 people and still not been able to do it, which is so funny to me, because Steven Soderbergh is like GOAT, because he, you know, that's not just somebody who directs. He writes, he directs, he edits, he shoots. Like, that is somebody who is multidisciplinary proficient and is grinding shit out, making multiple movies a year. He's a worker, bitch.
And so, but also, he gets it from the technical. He knows how the sausage is made. His style is so
informed. Understands the scrappiness of it, because that's a, you know, remember this franchise started out scrappy.
And he's like, I'm sure he murdered like 20 people doing this. It's such a good quote. But cracks me up.
It's so funny. And like, just I love seeing other filmmakers' reactions to it is so cool. But the other thing, like, you talk about stories or like little, you know, what if moments, is I, Colin Gibson always, he's such a loose unit, as mentioned, production designer who won the Oscar, as he should. But he always just had the best yarns. Especially like he would always talk shit about Mel Gibson in a way I found very endearing and interesting. But he just had the funniest yarns, and he's somebody I would end up talking to literally like every year and a half when they were in the process, like before they had even moved to Namibia. Like, he told me this story about how they had finally gotten it up and this thing was finally happening after six times and it's about to film in Broken Hill. And then there was a freak, like once in a generation flood. In Broken Hill, and he's like, our whole wasteland was suddenly luscious and green and full of flowers, and they were like, fat! And so they had to find like another option, another solution, which cracks me up. But things that he would say about every single thing you saw on screen in Mad Max Fury Road had to have not a purpose, purposes, plural. And so it's like all of the tiles in a bunch of the different rooms and stuff that you can see that are basically a Morton Joe's, you know, suite, the tiles are made out of microchips. Because he's like, what use would you have for phone microchips in this world, in this universe? You see people walking around that essentially have just cords or things like things that end up becoming part of a blood transfusion. Yeah. But you see characters collect them and keep those things. And it was such an interesting, ideology where he said every single thing we see in this movie has to have a purpose. It has to have minimum like 3 to 4 different functions. And yeah. Even the way they fucking, it's so annoying having a stroke because the way that my, no, hear me out, because the way my brain stores stuff is so diabolical because it's like.
Inside your mind is Immortan Joe's tower.
No, it's literally, it's just that monkey from Oz Perkins, The Monkey, one of the best movies of 2025, just banging the cymbals together and somebody's going to explode into a ball of blood, probably me. But I will have issues and struggles remembering to buy food or remembering my age or remembering birthdays or sometimes what day of the week it is. What is locked in my brain is the name of all the different individual fucking cars and Mad Max Fury Road. Like the Giga Horse stays with me.
Yep.
And the exact specs and specifications and all that shit.
Hey, I want to give you the heads up.
Hey.
Because
let me tell you, knowing what the name of the cars are does not get you laid.
No.
Because if that's what you're about to say, don't worry, it's gonna be a hit. I can tell you now. It ain't. Nobody cares.
No, I was just going to say this.
Not even rev heads. They just want to see a Monaro.
Okay.
And your tits.
You know. Yeah, well.
Yeah,
hello. The rev heads get it. I, as a father of two, I genuinely think like, you
as
know,
a father,
you meet so many new people because your kids have friends, you got school stuff, da, da, da. Let me tell you, the amount of children and parents' names that I forget, it's unfathomable. But do I remember the Giga Horse? Sure. Do I remember lines, like random lines from this movie? Yes. Oh do God. I remember the lines and names of characters in a whole bunch of random movies that I don't need to store? Not essential. Absolutely not essential. IMDb exists. I can find it. The stuff that I remember and the stuff that I don't want to remember that is sticky, you just like you have no idea. I have no idea how it works. All I know is that my head is also filled with completely useless information.
I think it makes me feel much better.
So I just think even if you hadn't had a stroke, I still think you forget what day it is, but you remember all the Mad Max cars.
That's kind. there was a time in my life I knew what day of the week it was.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Yeah, that's well, kind. Did that make you a better person? No.
No, I still had a stroke. Karma still got me. Anyway.
It's an amazing movie all round. It is endlessly rewatchable.
Still memeable.
So, like,
as somebody who curates the Monday meme drop once a week, the amount of random, like, there'll just be a flurry sometimes, a stretch of 2 to 3 days where Twitter has just decided, hey, babes, we're back on the Fury Road train. And everybody's suddenly making Fury Road jokes. The way that you know, hey, you can tell something is a genuine classic and penetrated is if a decade after, if 8 years after, 7.5 years, those weird years that are not big anniversary years, if sometimes it's very easy to get a ball rolling on a joke that resurges from that movie.
The That's Bait meme has been used a million times.
The don't become reliant on water one I have seen so many times in so many different scenarios that cracks me the fuck up.
Don't
become addicted or you will lose his absence. So funny. What a legend. R.I.P. to him. Like
an absolute
a goat. King. A true like king. Activist and ally and somebody who was fucking 10 toes down for all the right goddamn causes, literally jingle-jangled his way down every red carpet like a barnacle from fucking Moana, collecting badges and shit. And he would wear those badges. He would wear Aboriginal flag badges. Like, you name it. He was fucking Hugh Keysburn. Real one.
The realist.
Realist.
The realist.
Realist.
All the way from Stone. All the way from Stone, Mad Max.
Makes me really wonder what it would be like if he was, I often think about like how angry he would be with the world and how he would feel about the world in this specific time and situation, everything from, you know, not just the Trump shit, literally Trump being Immortan Joe and styled like him too, but especially Palestine. I'm just like, those are the voices and like staunch people who are unafraid to stand on business and be like, fuck my career. Like, I guess it's Melissa Barreras and shit like that. Yeah. But
He's back to Hugh Keyes for a second. I know we don't want to talk about Furiosa, but I just want to use Furiosa just temporarily because it was a movie that you and I were very, very not with. It did not resonate with us at all. And with all the love in the world to George Miller and all the creatives that created it, I didn't love it. The thing I did love about it was Chris Hemsworth being like basically doing his granddad's voice and being a complete weirdo. I did love that. But I just do want to say, like, I do like the actor Lockie Hume, who as an actor, just in like general, as a performer. Great, you know, Sliding Doors moment for a movie that we'll never cover on this show because we're a few years too late. But Sliding Doors was, he was the second guy in line for The Dark Knight, and Heath Ledger got it.
You were going to bring it up. No, but I was going to bring it up if you didn't bring it up. But is definitely the second story that comes out of his mouth
It's a huge Sliding Doors moment. I just want to say, if you watch Furiosa and you see his performance behind all of the same Morton Joe kit, he does not compare to Hugh Keyes Byrne. Hugh Keyes Byrne is doing something that is so malevolent and so impactful and instantly iconic. Like, he's like, it's the same as where I really realized how great Hugo Weaving was when I watched V for Vendetta. And I was just the performance behind a mask for the entire time, it's just like unbelievable.
You always have to think about too, like, if that was somebody else,
yeah.
What do you, like, you always think of that. Like, for instance, this is a weird example, but The Accountant, OG, is a movie that I really love, like a really great 5-star, 3-star movie. Yeah. And the one criticism I have about that movie is I think Anna Kendrick is miscast, not because she's a bad actor. I think she's a great actress. And even chronologically, she's like not that
Woman
much.
Woman of the Hour, baby.
Woman of the Hour, great movie, but she's not that different. Like, she isn't as much of an age difference between her and Ben Affleck as you think, but she presents so much younger. And so in that movie, it plays so badly when they're sort of setting up this romance between him and her. It feels like a dad hitting on a girl. Whereas if that had been, well, obviously timing wise, probably wouldn't have worked out to be Jennifer Garner. But if it was a woman of his own age or within his own age range, it would have felt more like an even match. And so it's just one of those things where it's like, okay, I always play that game in my head. Who would I put in that part? Like, who would I cast? I love Michelle Monaghan, I think, would always be somebody who's like quite interesting in that part or good in that part. But it's fascinating too, because I think the Lockie Hume is a Morton Joe thing. Yes, he's definitely not as good as Hugh Keyes Byrne, but to be fair, whoever could be. However, it's also I think issues with story and character all around that.
Yeah.
I think it's very visibly clear that there is uncertainty and a lack of visibility about motivations and direction and plot shit, and just that movie being a mess in so many critical ways that it can't afford to be, that you feel like you're getting 10 different versions of the character and none of them quite sync up and work together. And even something like, what's the fucking pig farmer that always Greener Dad plays?
Yeah.
It's something like that where it's like the difference of even you got the same actor playing the same character, but it's 8 years apart or 9 years apart or whatever it is. And why does the pig farmer work in one scenario and not the other?
He's the bullet farmer. But he just looks like a pig. And when you said pig farmer, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. I'm like, wait, he's not farming pigs, it's the bullet farmer.
It's bullet farmer. Yeah, I just always think of him because he's mad on the nipples and the toes. You remember? He's always touching his nipples. And it's like, that's such sicko George Miller shit where he's like takes beloved, even like with the Volvani, he takes all these beloved matriarchal actresses and he's like, oh, you want to see him shoot somebody? Shoot someone with a little gun and then they go under the wheels. Bam, bam, there you go. Fascinating. He thinks about cast in such a fascinating way, George Miller. He really sees things that other people don't see and can get things out of people that just other people can't.
Yeah, it's an amazing film. I don't know if there's much more that I can say. I'm so glad that you were here because you're such an acolyte and such an advocate of this movie, and thank you for your service and the service of cinephiles everywhere for everything that you've done around this. But a true treat of my cinema going life was that very screening with you.
That was, it's one of my favorite, most special shared movie memories. I think both because we love that movie so much. And there's lots of shared movie memories we have where the movie's quite bad. And that's been the thing that we remember and we chuckle about it when we get shushed by Margaret and David or whatever it is.
Yeah, shushed by Australian creative, critical, royalty.
Listen, everyone has a wanky Margaret and David story, but nobody has a story where they got shushed by them and then their shushing was mentioned in their review on television.
Yeah.
And that's special to us. But two other things I'll just say.
And shout out to the movie we watched, Olympus Has Fallen, because we were laughing at its...
It was the slow-mo...
American flag.
American flag falling to the crowd. Anyway, two quick things on Mad Max Fury Road. If you want to read any of the curatorial work, including Blake's piece on Sweet Country, you can find all of it on the ACME website, including links to the different objects and pieces that are in the museum on display and a bunch of the video essays. And included in it is a piece all about the representation of differently abled actors across Mad Max Fury Road and what that meant to people at the time, conversations that it sparked in terms of there were lots of movies that did not even audition actors with limb differences for the lead and then cast unknowns and put a prosthetic on or a green screen prosthesis essentially. Whereas with Mad Max Fury Road, it's like, yes, that was definitely the case. Charlize Theron is an able-bodied actress, but she's also an Oscar winner and a movie star, and that opened the movie. And they really were active in employing as many differently abled actors as they could in other positions, including my friend Quentin Kinahan, who has passed away now, we had a great conversation many, many, many times. There's pieces of it on the ACME website, but also privately about how he genuinely believed the work that had been done in Mad Max Fury Road to represent those with difference was going to change Hollywood, and how disappointed he was in the years following that when he expected the phone to be ringing and he expected jobs to be on his plate and he expected all of the people within his community who'd worked on that film and experienced a production like that with such respect and reverence and professionalism that he expected all of their lives and careers to change, and how unfortunately that didn't happen because there aren't that many people out there who are genuine like masters of the craft a la George Miller, but also somebody like George Miller who sees the world differently. And I always thought that was such a beautiful but also very sad sort of lasting legacy of that film.
Yeah, it has mystified people. And I think that that speaks to it, the fact, and I don't mean like mystical, I mean like it's flabbergasted people, because it's like even the most experienced of directors, they don't know how he shot it. Even the most long-standing casting folk were just like, couldn't believe the way that he made the cast up, how he cast all these different people, whether it's like unknowns, whether it's these like random people who become these huge Titanic figures, whether it's all these like wonderfully interesting and different people. It's mystified people, but one thing that it did uniquely is that it deeply connected with its audience, and it continues to. And I just think that you only have to speak to its legacy that a whole movie is leading up to, and in fact references, so you can kind of get the jolt and the sense memory of what it was like to watch that movie and had so many people running, screaming, coming back to Fury Road, because it's just unbelievable.
And let's also never forget the other so rarely spoken about but much appreciated legacy of Mad Max Fury Road, which is, if it wasn't for Jenny Bevan getting called a bag lady, we wouldn't have all gotten together and bullied Stephen Fry off Twitter. And that, to me, is beautiful. He had to run home to his 26-year-old husband and cry himself to sleep. That's what we're here for. Collective bullying when necessary.
Oh, bless. You know what? In the wasteland, justice is it's dished out in a very satisfying way.
Shiny and go the fuck home, bitch.